Maine's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. We're talking about dogs on today's show. Anchorage has a network of dog parks for different kinds of breeds that have different needs. Running free, chasing a frisbee, swimming, whatever. Now there's a group that wants to build a dog park with play equipment in South Anchorage, and they're getting help together to do that. We'll talk about using the dog parks, and I'll have a guest to talk about dogs and the law, including trapping and issues for rural dogs. Did you know that judges in Alaska can consider a dog's interest in divorce proceedings? Finally, I'm checking in with a former guest, the father of a family sailing around the world. They've run into some serious problems in Iceland and are fighting to keep their trip alive. It's all ahead on Outdoor Explorer, Alaska Public Media's audio outdoor magazine. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth, and my daughter lives in New York City and wants to have a dog. And I think about the fact that she lives in an apartment, and essentially this poor little animal would be indoors and then walked around on the end of a string all the time. And that's not the Alaskan way, right? We like to have our dogs running around a bit. But until not that long ago, if you lived in Anchorage, essentially you were in the same spot. You needed to have a yard or walk your dog. But now we have dog parks, and the dogs can run around and they can kind of socialize with other dogs and have fun. And so that's going to be our topic for this segment, is talking about dog parks and some ideas for expanding them and making them even better. And for my guests for that topic are Patty Higgins, who's the Parks and Rec Committee, a member for the Abbott Loop Community Council. Thanks for being here, Patty.
Thank you, Charles.
And Kathy Forster, who's a dog owner and dog park user. Thanks for being here, Kathy.
Thank you, Charles.
So I just wanted to start with talking about your dogs and what you do at dog parks. Patty, you said you had a border collie, which is like one of the cutest dogs around.
They're very cute. They're very intelligent. When we started this dog park, I was between dogs. I had had a collie and then two Shelties, and I knew I was going to get a border collie, and I knew that they're really smart, and I knew that they needed way more enrichment than even a Sheltie needed, mm-hmm. which is intimidating. So in this dog park, I sort of focused on dog enrichment,
right?
Because all dogs need that, just border collies.
Keeping the brain active and as well as the body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Kathy, tell me about your dog.
Well, currently we have a half lab, half Weimaraner, and both breeds need a lot of exercise. Labs need a lot of socialization. And so the dog park is a perfect place to take our dog to fill those needs.
Yeah. Well, labs are really popular dogs in Alaska, and they're big, active dogs, right? I mean, because they're bred for hunting.
Right. Well, and this is our second part lab, and the ones that we've had, our experience with labs is that they're bred for party, and
that's right.
They're a party waiting to happen, and they're just waiting for you to show up.
They're bred for whacking you with that big tail.
The big tail. That's right.
Nothing that little get a little kid crying faster than being hit in the face with a lab's tail, right?
Right.
So, Patty, tell me about, what is your project? What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, there was already a movement for people to do a dog park in South Anchorage because there isn't one in that area.
Hmm.
So they were looking in our community council boundaries, and it just so happened that Whisper Faith Kovach Park, which is on 76 or Lohr, almost to the Seward Highway, they needed a swing set. They had some equipment, but no swings. So we looked at that field, and there's this huge field that is used for pickup soccer sometimes, but not really used. It's pretty wet. So we said, well, this would be a good combination, because maybe a dog park will help keep lesser good elements mm-hmm. from hanging out in the parking lot and doing things.
Because the park is used, it's going to be safer.
Right.
Because there'll
be
people
a good
there.
Flow of
yeah.
people.
And University Lake Dog Park is a good example of, mm-hmm. of how that works. That University Lake area used to be a place where a lot of homeless people would set up their
mm-hmm.
camps.
Right.
But now it's so heavily trafficked with dog park users and bikers and cross-country skiers that it's just too active an area for
yeah,
people
it's
to feel
really,
comfortable
yeah,
setting
it's
up
it's really
home.
Busy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this park is situated in the middle of a pretty dense neighborhood of single-family homes. There's apartments, And then there's duplexes and fourplexes all up and down Lohr. So there are a lot of kids.
Yeah, I can't really, I really can't picture Whisper Faith Kovach-Bach. She was a little girl who was killed in an accident on Lohr Road back in the 90s.
Right, she was running across the street to get to an ice cream truck.
Right.
They named the park after her.
So and it's kind of a neighborhood park for that area?
Definitely.
Yeah.
So we brought this to the attention of Parks and Rec, and they are just beyond fabulous. And looked at the playground equipment there, and they said, oh, this is very outdated. It has pebbles as the surface material, which is no longer considered good. I don't really know why we ever thought it was good. And it's not ADA accessible. So they said, well, we just need to redo that whole thing. We'll keep the footprint because it had a good infrastructure. But they're going to put in all new equipment, and we're going to get swings, and we're going to get a mom and child swing, too, which is really fun. If you've ever seen a baby in one of those, they just crack up. They think it's so funny. Mom or dad is right there with them. So there will be a lot of amenities just for community building and neighborhood building. There'll be a chess table and benches.
Nice.
But not inside the park, because I think we don't want people sitting in the dog park and talking to the humans, because they really need to be attuned to the dogs.
So in terms of the dog park, are you going to have equipment for play equipment for the dogs?
That is our dream.
Okay.
And so to meet that,
I love it.
We're going to do some fundraising and get some volunteer labor in there. And I have lots of pictures of equipment that could be used. dogs like to go through tunnels. They like to jump over things. And some of these equipment might be expensive if you purchase them brand new. But, you know, hoops, you can just get a super big tire.
And so this will be great for your border collie, because they love to do that kind of thing, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, Kathy, is this a new thing for dog parks around town? Do we have, like, dog play equipment at other dog parks?
Other than the natural environment, how dogs turn that into play, like a mound will be a nice place to play for dogs to play King of the Hill. But no, there's nothing man-made in the dog parks.
I saw something like this at the town where my son goes to college in Pennsylvania, where it looks like a kid's playground, but it's a dog park, and it's got all kinds of different equipment for them to run around on, which is sort of a new, I guess people are treating their dogs like kids these days, so I guess that makes sense.
Along those lines, when we took our previous dog through puppy training, there were several other dogs in there. At puppy graduation, this one couple who had been bringing their dog brought their parents, and the parents and the parents said, "This is our only grandchild."
Right. it may end up being.
And likely will. That's right.
So some of the other dog parks do have kind of fun. Like you mentioned University Lake. That's a great place. Dogs love to swim. Some do.
Right.
And then what are some of the other ones? Some of them off, so people don't know.
There's one off of Clatt. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and there's another one over by Connor Bog on the way to the airport. Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of just a big sort of wooded area. So,
and that's a great place. It's the only dog park in town that just has long areas where you can just get on a bike and run your dog. And half lab, half Weimaraner, all crazy. My dog needs to run. So we can get on mountain bikes and circle the 1.1 mile lap at University Lake. But that's kind of treacherous with all the people. But Connor Bog has just a long path that you can run your dog on, and it's got some side paths that the dog can run off into the woods. It's a lovely park.
Yeah. So is it all fenced? I mean, what happens if the dog wants to take off?
Well, it's not all fenced. There is some restriction for the dogs, but if you've got a goodbye dog, you might lose him onto Jewel Lake Road.
Yeah. Okay. So the different parks for different people.
Different parks for different people.
Then there's one down on
Valley of the Moon.
Rocket Park. Yeah.
Yeah. There's one by Valley of the
Moon. And that's just sort of a fenced former baseball diamond, I think.
Right. It's a smaller one. It's more for dogs that want to interact with one another or just play fetch. University Lake and Connor's Bog are the only ones. If you want to go hike with your dog, you could actually with your dog.
Yeah.
And different dogs have different needs. There are a lot of dogs that just want to hang out with other dogs or run after a ball. And Valley of the Moon is perfect for that. And the one off of Clatt is good for that as well.
So this dog socialization is a big part of it.
Right.
Yeah.
And the level of the dog's ability. Like my puppy cannot reliably come to me when I call her. So I need to keep her in a fenced dog park. And you're not supposed to bring them until they're 6 months old, so she's only 8 months. But we did go to the one on Clatt. We were the only ones in the fenced part. There were lots of dogs walking loose in the whole big area because it hasn't been developed yet.
Yeah.
But that was really fun.
So you mentioned a six-month rule. What are some of the other rules?
Well, the most important rule is have your dog up on its all of its shots. And then after that, I would say the next most important rule is make sure that your dog is not aggressive. And then third would be clean up after your dog.
Just because it's a dog park doesn't mean it's like a dog sort of like
Club, your mom's not going to come behind you and clean up after you. And I laugh and say, you know, there are very few bad dogs, but I run into a lot of bad owners.
Yeah.
And my husband and I often in the wintertime, because we're embarrassed by the bad behavior of others, because it reflects on all dog owners, we'll often just go out with a couple of large, you know, the 33-gallon garbage bags and a couple of trowels, and just go around and scoop the poop in the dead of winter and just let our dog run around in the dog park while we're cleaning up everybody else's
mess.
When
it's frozen, it's not quite as gross,
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's definitely a pet peeve for a lot of us, I think, especially out on the coastal trail or the other bike trails when people have been inconsiderate or have just been forgetful and they leave the little plastic bag of poop hanging on the bushes and forget to come back for it.
Well, and that's another thing. You know, a lot of people fuss, you know, if I leave a bag of poop, they'll say, well, you're just leaving that. Well, no, actually, I always come back the way I went. And if I find any other bags along the way, I'll pick them up as well, because some people do forget, or some people do have unforeseen circumstances that change their path. So if you are a dog walker and you see those bags out there, and just because they don't have your name on them doesn't mean you can't pick them up and take them back to the garbage
can. Being a good neighbor in this isn't everything is appreciated by everybody. Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and we're talking about dog parks. Why not get your dog out there and have some fun with them? Lots of opportunities. Kathy Forrester is here. She's an avid dog park user and poop picker-upper.
I'm very proud of that.
Yes. And Patty Higgins is with the Abbott Loop Community Council and is working on a project to fix up a dog park at Whisper Faith Kovac Park, right? That's the right name, with equipment so the dogs can have a playground. So, Patty, tell us more about how you're bringing this about. You're having a fundraiser.
Right. So we have the bulk of the funds. Anchorage generously passed the bond package in last April. So we're good with the fencing and the major part. But then these little things that will make this just an outstanding park, we're going to do fundraising for. The Anchorage Parks Foundation has granted us a challenge grant. So if we raise $13,000, they will give us $13,000 additional dollars.
Nice.
We'd like to have a station where the dogs can go get water. I've seen some where they have a fire hydrant that sprays water and the dogs just love it. They go running through it.
Yeah.
You know, very much like children do.
Yeah.
And then some of the play equipment, like I said, it could be purchased or people could build it. We need a super big tire. So to do this, Little Italy has generously given us a fundraiser. It'll be in February. Right before Valentine's Day. It'll be February 5th from 5:30 to 8:30. PJ will have complimentary pizza and soft drinks, wine and beer for purchase. There'll be a silent auction and a lot of people, kindred spirits. If you like dogs, these will be the creme de la creme of dog.
I'm sure you have a Facebook page or a website that we can link to from outdoorexplorer.org.
Yes.
All right.
Oh, great. So thank you.
Come to our link at outdoorexplorer.org, and you can find out about how to support this new dog park effort. I'm curious about you mentioned the shots, and when dogs are interacting with other dogs, there's bad things that can happen in terms of passing sort of different dog diseases, I guess. Is this an issue to protect your own dog, or is it to protect the whole community, or what?
Well, it's both. But one of the things that you can do to protect your own dog, and it's not a surefire 100% protection, but make sure they're up on their Bordetella, which is commonly called kennel cough. the people who run kennels don't like it called that, but that's what people recognize it as. Because dogs can pass on these little viruses, and the kennel cough helps, the Bordetella shots help prevent those. And I did forget to mention another thing that you can do that's just part of being a good citizen is keep your dog's registration current. It's not very expensive, but the money that's used for that goes to do things that provide services for the citywide dog users, such as those little mutt mitts that are available throughout all the parks that allow you to scoop your own dog's poop without touching it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And for the puppies, they say to wait 6 months because their immune system isn't really up to speed. So even though she's had all of her shots, they really recommend to wait to take her by the other. And maybe it's a maturity issue too, but mostly it was because of the shots. And I watched Cesar Millan, and he's done a couple of episodes on dog parks. And what really struck me is a lot of people would get out of the car with their dog, and they're hyping them up. All right, let's go play, let's go play, let's go play. And you don't want to bring a dog into a park in that state of mind.
Right.
You want to take advantage of this double gate system and bring them in and just sit them down and let them scope out what's there, have the other dogs come sniff through the fence. And then when your dog is calm, take them into the park.
So the double gate system, I wasn't aware of that.
Not every park has it, but it's a nice thing. Now, as
how,
Patty
how does
speaks,
that, so you go in your, it's like an Arctic entry, and so that just so that they can acclimatize themselves to the park.
Right.
Interesting.
So as Patty was speaking, it became clear to me that she's never had a half lab, half Weimaraner,
no.
Because all I have to do is put on the clothes that I typically wear when I take him for a hike, and he's immediately
goes nuts.
And,
yeah,
and then the whole ride in the car, I have to put in earplugs because he's going he, which is not saying I'm afraid of the car. It's saying we're not there yet.
I'm
why,
so excited.
Why?
Yeah. Let's go.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would think that there could be overexcited dogs who get in conflict with other dogs. Is that something you guys have seen at the dog parks, like fights and that sort of thing?
Well, it's very rare, but it does happen. And as I said earlier, I don't see bad dogs. I see bad owners. You know, something that happened once to my dog and me at the dog park at University Lake, we were doing the loop, and my dog loves little ones because we got him from a family that had two little girls, and when he sees small children, it's like, oh, they're my babies. So there was a mother, and she had her toddler in a stroller, and he walked up and with his tail wagging and peeked into the stroller. He didn't touch, you know, he just mm-hmm. looked, and her dog immediately attacked him.
Mm-hmm.
And her excuse was, he's very protective. He always attacks dogs that get too close to the stroller. And my immediate thought was, then why are you bringing this stroller to an off-leash dog park?
Right.
Yeah, good point.
Crazy.
Yeah. So it's, and I don't think that, I'm not saying that she was a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying that not enough thought went into her decision to bring that dog to that setting.
Yeah. I mean, the flip side about dog parks, which is great, is if you don't want to be around dogs, you don't have to go to the dog park, right? There's a lot of other parks. Do you think that there's enough dog parks? Are they crowded, or is it an adequate supply?
I think that we could use more, but, you know, I don't want to complain. We've got quite a few, and they're lovely.
Yeah, and it sounds like you think they're pretty well managed, Patty, but Parks and Rec.
Well, I think, right. But I think we can do better.
Mm-hmm.
I think about the AEDC's goal to have Anchorage the number one place in the country by 2025. So this will be one of the gems in a jewel in our Parks and Rec program.
See if we can have the best dog parks anywhere.
The best dog. And it's something I forgot to mention.
We've already got the best trails, right?
Oh, yeah. And the best scenery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, along those lines, another thing that we could do that I think would improve the setting of the city for dog owners. My husband and I spent a lot of time in Austin, and the city laws allow with certain restrictions dogs to come into restaurants, and people in the audience are probably rolling their eyes as I say that, but they have certain areas and certain restrictions. There's a place in Austin that even has part of their menu for what you can give your dog while you're there with it.
Wow.
And we don't have that here. You know, a perfect place would be Bernie's Bungalow. You know, they've got lovely lawn area.
Lounge downtown with the yard. Yeah. I walk by it and I think, how could people be sitting out when it's this cold?
But that's another topic. And if you were allowed to bring your dog there and not take it inside, but take it there, that would be great.
Yeah. Patty, did you have some final thoughts?
I think about Juno, and you know, the dogs in Juno are pretty well all socialized. And you go into the grocery store and there's two or three dogs just laying there waiting for their human to come back out.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and I've gone into legislators' offices and the legislator says, hope you don't mind my dog. He misses me if I leave him at home during
bringing
the day.
Dogs to work, everything else, as long as no one's allergic. So, there was a funny feature in the newspaper, The Sad Dogs of Fire Island Bakery, and it was just a picture of dogs waiting outside.
Oh, too funny.
Yeah.
I did forget to mention that in our dog park, not only do we have the double gate system, we actually have separated it into two spaces. So one is a fenced off area for small dogs, and then the larger area is for all dogs. So if you have a little dog, you can bring him into the all dog park.
And is the large area fenced too, or is that? Mm-hmm. Okay, great. That
so it's like actually two fenced dog parks in a way.
And this is in a former soccer field that wasn't getting much use.
Well, they were using it to play soccer, but there was no official.
Oh, I see.
Pick up games, just an open area.
I got you. Yeah. Well, this has been fun. Thanks so much for coming in. I've learned a lot about dog parks, and it seems like anybody with a dog should get out there and use them.
There you go.
Well, anybody without a dog that likes dogs, I have
friends. Then you don't have to have one. They're expensive and a lot of trouble to have, right?
Exactly. I have friends who go there and just so they can pet other people's dogs.
Oh, that's neat. All right. Kathy Forrester, dog park user, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
And Patty Higgins with the Abbott Loop Community Council. She's raising money to build a dog park with play equipment, just like a kid's park. Thanks for being here, Patty.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
And you can find out more about Patty's project by going to outdoorexplorer.org and clicking on today's show. So please stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Well, we're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about dogs today. And here's an angle that we haven't touched on before. Dogs in the law, dogs in politics. And I've got a real expert on the subject with me right now. Michael Hockadalen is an animal welfare consultant and lobbyist. Who knew that dogs had lobbyists? He's formerly with the SPCA and the Humane Society. And he's done some really important work in Juneau on animals and keeping them safe. And thanks for being here, Michael.
Oh, thanks. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm honored.
Well, I'm honored to have you. You worked with the late Representative Max Grunberg on a bill that we kind of got a lot of national attention, had various aspects, but one part of it was dogs in divorce custody proceedings and recognizing that they're more than property.
It was transformational law. It was an incredible honor to work with Representative Grunberg and his staff, as well as Representative Liz Vasquez. And I worked on this bill very closely with them for a couple of years, and we passed a very big, ambitious bill, which was important to Representative Grunberg near the end of his long career. But the most long-lasting thing that he did with this bill is that in our state now, a judge may consider the well-being of an animal in determining custody in a divorce case.
So we think about a child custody, and this is a bit, I mean, this is similar but different. I mean, before, the dog was just like a chest of drawers or a car, and now it's not quite a child, but it's what its well-being matters.
Thank you for that. That's exactly what's going on here and why it's transformational. Animals are typically considered property, and so they would be dispersed in a custody case, not even custody, but distribution of property case, like a car or an IRA or an investment account or a kitchen table, as you said. Now they're being considered something other than property, certainly not like children. We went out of our way to make sure that that wasn't the unintended impression in the public. The standard for children in these types of situations is the best interest of the children. And I apologize, I am an attorney. Please don't hold that against me. But these words make a lot, they have a lot of meaning. And a best interest standard afforded children, as is appropriate, is quite a bit higher than the well-being standard that Representative Grunberg and I came up with in trying to figure out how to do something to move things forward, because so many people consider their pets as something much, much different than their golf clubs.
Yeah, and I think, I feel like Alaskans feel that way stronger than maybe people other places. At least we certainly feel it very strongly here. And in the same bill, protecting animals in domestic violence situations, which makes all kinds of sense. Because somebody who's violent to their spouse obviously be violent to the pet too, but groundbreaking and something that other states are now copying, I guess.
Yeah, the well-being of the animal standard is being copied elsewhere. I know that Illinois just passed one, and I think there are pending bills with new sessions starting up in other states. So that's going to be, I'm very grateful to my wonderful mentor, Max Grunberg. Yeah. This will be part of his great legacy. There was a component of the bill about adding pets to the protective orders. And what we did on that mostly was we have an incredible domestic violence advocacy community in our state. They're just outstanding, and we did nothing other than try and honor the great things that they themselves have accomplished by putting some of the already existing procedures and forms that they were using very successfully, including in putting animals on protective orders. We put them in statutes so that they're more durable, and it will honor their work by making it harder to undo. So
neat. Yeah. It's neat knowing that there's somebody down there in Juneau or in the city council chambers who's actually advocating for animals and not just for some company or some special interest group. I mean, and that must be a rewarding job for you.
Well, I'm gonna borrow some words from another mentor, Mary Shields, up in Fairbanks, and she's a musher and an animal lover. And I talked to her, and I've learned a lot from her. And like Mary, I feel like I'm the luckiest person in Alaska most of the time. I get to work on important issues. I learn from many, many different people all across the state. I work with legislators and state officials, but I also work closely with animal control officers and shelters and agencies, nonprofits all across the state, and they're the ones that inform most of my work. I'm grateful to be in a position to sort of be the link because, notwithstanding good intentions, a lot of the folks I represent are nonprofit groups that don't have a lot of money, and most of their program expenses go to program expenses. And so I'm not the lobbyist that goes down there and wines and dines.
Right.
But at the same time, I'm very grateful and fortunate because my role, I see it, is to represent all of those agencies because they're wonderful. They're very knowledgeable. They know what's going on where they are and what's important.
Do many of the legislators have dogs in the Capitol building?
That's sort of at times controversial. I think there's at least one service animal in there now. There is a general, non-service animals are not permitted.
Supposed to be, but I've seen them.
Well, there was an incident that I won't go into I always say even with dog parks, we've talked about dog parks, people need to be responsible with their animals pick up after them, clean up with them, and not put them in situations where they maybe shouldn't be based on their behavior.
Well, we were talking before we started the interview about the issue of service animals and emotional support dogs and this very gray area that's developed, which seems to be maybe creating a backlash against important service animals because people abusing that. Is that a concern of yours?
It's a big concern of mine, and I appreciate that you brought that up. I've been approached by maybe a half dozen people over the last 6 months expressing their concern over confusion between what's a service animal, what's an emotional support animal, what are the rights and the responsibilities of those folks. I love dogs, and every time I get on I travel by plane, I look at people who have their little dogs with them. My dogs are quite a bit too large to do that. But there are people who do that. They cheat the system a little bit, and it's not okay. reflects poorly on all of us, but also the most important thing is that it imperils the rights of those people who absolutely do have a legitimate need and interest in having those privileges. So I'm not quite sure if state legislation or what educational outreach is the way to go about it, but it is something that I'm going to be working on and inquiring on, learning more about with and speaking with legislators and finding out what might be the best way to approach, if nothing else, just some education and getting out there and saying, you know, these three categories of service animals are distinct, and they have they go through a vetting process, and they're very well behaved and trained, and they're very expensive, and they are different than my dog sitting next to me because I want him to see out the window and look at the glaciers. Yeah,
right. So, getting back to that, some outdoors issues. I think one of the biggest outdoor conflicts around dogs has been the issue of trapping. And it's an issue sort of here in Chugach State Park, and it was certainly an issue in the Mat-Su Valley where they actually passed a law. What are your thoughts on how that conflict can be resolved or worked through in a state where, you know, the trapping and hunting is so important, but also people want their dogs to be safe?
Well, I work on wildlife issues as well as companion animal issues, and I try to be annoyingly at times good at seeing both sides of an issue. And I understand the interest in the cultural heritage and people like to do trapping. I think there's a wide range between overly permissive trapping and concurrent use with other user groups. And so I think that some trapping laws and reforms are a good idea. I don't think it's unreasonable to ask to set specified areas that would be high use, and instead of having traps that are 10 or 20 feet off the trail, a high user group trail, an authentic trapper or hunter, I think, would be fine with getting off the trail to do things and mm-hmm. not imperil. And I also think that the notion that there are leash laws and dogs should always be under control is a bit of a red herring. We are in Alaska. We love our dogs.
When you're out in the woods, yeah.
You don't want to have your dog all the time. We love to enjoy them and make their lives good, too.
Let me just say, in town, in the urban setting, yes, leash. Yeah. But when you're out in the woods, that's another matter. Yeah.
Absolutely. And some dogs do well, and some dogs don't. I'm not, you know, advocating for just letting them go and hoping for the best. At the same time, I'm not sure that a state law is the way to go about this, because in my mind, we really only need these in our larger communities. And I know the Mat-Su had some great success. Had nothing to do with that, and I greatly admire everybody involved in that. But I think in Anchorage, in Juneau, I know folks in Fairbanks are interested in doing it. And again, I think there's a great range of what's, not trying to ban trapping or relieve people of the opportunity to do these important things. There's a big range of something in the middle that can be a compromise to keep the dogs and the pets safe, but still enjoy these paradigmatic Alaskan activities.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I mean, the dogs are a part of rural Alaska going back, many, many centuries. But there's an animal care problem in rural Alaska, and a problem of stray dogs, and also just the difficulty of animals getting care. And I know that's a concern of yours, maybe not an easy one to resolve. But what are your thoughts on animal care in rural Alaska, away from the areas where we have vets, away from the areas we have shelters, and what we can do about that?
This is the issue that I work on. It's in my mind more than any. It's a very complicated issue. It brings in a lot of issues of culture and access and commerce and things like that. And every day, all of my work, even if it's working on a different issue, it's part of my effort to gain partnerships and understand people and educate them on my perspectives on how important this is. Access to veterinary care and also regular spay-neuter in our rural communities that are off the road system is a huge challenge in terms of expenses. It's a logistically challenging problem, getting veterinarians and licensed professionals to certain areas is very difficult. But we have a small army of people working on it, and they're great, and I learned a lot from them. With all the respect I have for these groups, there's no way we're addressing the need at this point. I think what I look at it is we're learning what works, what doesn't work from experts, folks that are doing this. And there are several in the state.
There's a big challenge ahead to deal with that. Yeah,
I think it's a big enough challenge that it's going to take an effort, a very large coordinated effort with a lot of stakeholders, way up to the state level, so a public-private effort.
Yeah.
And it's an important issue because it's a public health issue at a certain level. You know, we love dogs and cats. I certainly do, and many, many people do. But it's more than just being nice to dogs and cats. It's taking care of rural areas, protecting them from zoonotic diseases that get out there, rabies cases. And it's also a means of reducing the number of unwanted dogs or unowned dogs. That's a terrible tragedy. And they get treated. They have very tough, desperate lives.
Yeah. And that's a big issue, but I'm glad you're working on it, Michael. Michael Hockadalen is an animal welfare consultant and lobbyist. He used to be with SPCA and Humane Society. If you want to reach Michael, we'll have his link on ours at outdoorexplorer.org on today's show. And he's looking for ideas, and he's really working on these things, and so he's trying to network. Thanks so much for being here today.
It's a great experience. Thank you very much.
Please stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. It's Charles Wolfworth, and I have a guest with me now from Switzerland. Dario Schwerer is someone we've had on the show twice before. He was with us when he was sailing here through Anchorage on this amazing voyage he's on, and then again after he'd sailed through the Northwest Passage with his family, and he showed up on the east coast of the United States, and we had him on by phone. Now the boat is in Iceland. Dario is in Switzerland. His journey, called Top to Top, is climbing the seven highest peaks of the seven continents by human power and sail. And they've done most of it. It's taken a very long time. They've had children along the way. A big family is doing this journey now. And you can learn more about that from our previous interviews, which we'll put up on our website at outdoorexplorer.org. But I just wanted to check in with Dario now because he's had a bit of a disaster with the boat in Iceland. Dario, it sounds like you're facing one of the biggest challenges you've had yet with the boat really largely destroyed by a storm when you were right there in port. And I've seen the video. Looks very destructive. What exactly happened to the boat?
The boat is damaged, especially on the starboard side. The reason was a major storm, very exceptional, in the port of Akureyri at the Arctic Circle in the very north of Iceland, when really crazy winds come just in a right angle into this fjord and caused a very steep sea we never have seen before. And this really steep waves with the periods were just some seconds crashed everything. So we have had about 2.5 inches ropes to shore, and we put 8 car tires in between as shock absorbers. And in the lines, we put about 80 pounds of rocks into old fishing nets and went about 12 feet down with that, also as shock absorbers. And that all was not enough. It just ripped out our cleats on the boat. And then we managed, really, thanks to all the 6 kids on board and 1 volunteer, to get to another dock and not into the rocks, but we were on we were on the roof side of this dock, and it was concrete, and this steep sea just crashed us into this always sideways into this concrete dock. And my son Andre, 11 year old, he was his task is to call on the radio, so he did a pan pan to the Coast Guard, and they were there coming from land very fast with the firefighters too, but they couldn't access this dock because it was like moving like a wild snake. It was a floating concrete dock, and so we were by ourselves for about nearly an hour fighting to keep the boat afloat.
That must have been terrifying with the children on board to be with the boat bouncing up and down and in such a dangerous situation.
I think it was for sure terrifying, but I think our kids are kind of used to tough situations, and they didn't cry. They really have done a fantastic job and not panicking. We did a lot of drills in all these years with them, so that was really paying off for all the effort we put in training. And I really can say our kids were saving the boat. So two kids were on bilge pumps pumping like wild when water was entering the boat, so they really kept the boat afloat. So and then after about an hour, the storm was diminishing, and the rescuers, they could access this float. They were putting fixed ropes that they don't get smashed away, and then we were able to put big truck tires in between. And but it was for sure another big experience in our expedition. And
if the listeners don't know, this boat is not only the mode of travel with which you're going all over the world, but it's also your family home. Were you then displaced out of home right there during the holidays or before the holidays as because of this damage to the boat?
Yeah, it was fantastic. I mean, just in the morning when we were still pumping, the mayor showed up, and just people from Akureyri, this town in the north of Iceland. We have been in many schools in the surroundings, so everybody showed us and tried to help. And a fisherman offered us his house where we could live now, since now. And because he was renting the house out over Christmas, New Year to some skiers, we didn't have had a place to go because we cannot live on the boat anymore. We got a container from the city there to put all our belongings into a container. And so we were till now in this house. And over Christmas, New Year, somebody offered us a ticket to go back to Switzerland so that we can see last time our grandma. She's just at the same time. That's bad timing. She's just dying, and we needed also a new passport issued for our newborn, who was born off the Greenland. So we were last summer operating in East Greenland. And we needed a passport for Vital. So now we are in Switzerland probably for a week or two to see family and get also timber organized we need in Iceland and ship that to Iceland so that we can start repairing our home and boat.
So you're not giving up on your expedition. How much do you think it will take, how long, and how much money to repair the boat and get underway again?
I think that the first estimates were by 75,000 Swiss francs or US dollars. and a friend of mine started a crowdfunding website on a donor box with the title Help Pachamama, that's the boat's name. And that went quite well. We guess it's probably more maybe going to 80 or 90,000 now, because we are really remote, and we have had now just only about 2.5 or 3 hours of daylight. So it's not an easy place to fix a boat, especially when you hear that's the third windiest place on the planet.
Wow.
But especially also our kids, they are really drilled to repair it. So the first thing when I came back after about 24 hours pumping on the boat, when I saw the kids again in this house of the fishermen, was that they asked Sabine, my wife, and me that we really promise that we fix the boat, because they are so much in love in this boat. And this boat has done now more than 120,000 nautical miles, and they were all born. And I mean, that's really their home.
This is the only place they've ever lived, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's probably for them really an important life experience. You know, there are not so many people that can say, okay, my house burned down, or now we have quite a huge avalanche risk here in Switzerland, in the Swiss Alps, where you can say, okay, my house was wiped out from an avalanche. There's not so many people that can say my house nearly sunk. So in this, I think it's really important also for the kids to overcome this drama, that you show them that even when you are totally down, you can just build it up again. And they are really thrilled to do that. So and I think it's probably also a good experience for them to to be in a situation like that once, and see that life continues and you can work your way out of it.
It's a big setback, but at least everyone is safe, and now you're with family and you're able to go on and hopefully repair what was broken and continue. Do you foresee your journey going next after you've managed these repairs, assuming you can do it?
So we have last summer we recognized again, but already the Northwest Passage, what's happening with the Inuit communities, especially with the young people and kids up there, that they really get more and more frustrated about the impact of climate change, and the freezing is much, much later and break up much earlier. So they really lose their existence in a way that they lose their hunting grounds. So in East Greenland, we saw many families, they started to kill their dogs. They have normally about 20 to 30 sled dogs, because they are not of use anymore. They cannot go so far anymore, and they need seals to feed them, and they cannot go so far. So their hunting grounds are really shrinking. And so what we did last summer in East Greenland, and you have to understand, it's a huge coastline, not like in Western Greenland. It's a huge coastline where there are living only 3,500 people. And in the settlements, you know, you see the same a little bit like in northern Alaska or in northern Canada, where these hunters stay home watching TV and just drive to the northern stores to get some liquor. And I think we really have to bring them another perspective. And what we did is we started climbing courses, and this spring we'd like to start to teach them skiing, because we saw that it's really a tourist, a boom for tourism. So more and more people go there to explore. And they bring their own guides from down south. So when we can teach them how to climb and how to ski, and they will be the best guides, you know. So
yeah, great idea.
That would be really a good way to make a living, and that they can stay in their communities.
So that's your next goal. Well, I wish you all luck, Dario. I know a lot of Alaskans remember when you were here and spent a winter in Cordova and then went through the Northwest Passage, starting from Northwest Alaska. I will have an article that I wrote about Dario and his family on our site at outdoorexplorer.org, as well as a link to his site, which is amazing and has got these extraordinary photos and a map of his journey and a blog. And you can learn about how you can support the family and their expeditions and good work if you'd like to do so as well. So all luck to you, and best wishes to you and your family, Dario. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much to all Alaskans, and I really like to say hello especially to all our friends in Cordova, and I have to tell them that the wind we experienced in Cordova was much more than now in Akureyri. But Cordova has a much more protected harbor, so
yeah.
That was probably the issue this time. And we are really looking forward to come back to Alaska. So we hope to be back in about 2 years from now, maybe going to the around the Arctic through the Northeast Passage. We are really looking forward to be back in Alaska.
Wonderful.
So, thank you so much. And please keep the Alaskan wildlife retreat alive. So that's, we heard that they like to do some test drilling. So please keep this wonderful spot we experienced in 2016 when we went to the Northwest Passage. Like it is. So it's really a unique place on the planet we have never seen before.
Yes, indeed. All right. Thank you so much, Dario Schwörer, the Top to Top Expedition, and speaking to us via Skype from Switzerland. And we'll keep track of Dario and bring him back periodically to let you know about his amazing adventures with his family. So please stay with us. Outdoor Explorer continues. I'm Charles Wolforth. For this next segment, we have a piece that's more than a few years old, and it comes from Alaska Teen Media Institute, where reporter Ishmael Strever did a story about teen musher Seiji Takagi, who is preparing for his biggest race, the 2011 Junior Iditarod.
I'm Seiji Takagi. I go to South Anchorage High School, and I'm 14 years old, and I am planning to run my first mid-distance race, the Junior Iditarod, in the end of February.
Seiji got started with mushing in the second grade when he was at a friend's house in Wasilla, and he was instantly hooked. That initial ride was an experience he wasn't able to get out of his head. His family eventually bought four dogs, and the training began. He's competed in sprint races all over Anchorage, and he's been training for his first Junior Iditarod. The training consisted of tying dogs to four-wheelers during the summer, and when the snow fell, that's when he brought out the sleds. A big part of his training was understanding how the dogs behave, which he learned from handling dogs for his mentor, Christine Roloffs.
If they are tired, then they will clearly show that they don't want to run anymore. A couple of them will just lay down and let themselves get dragged. In that case, I will put them in my sled so that they can rest, and if they're not doing good, if they're clearly not wanting to run anymore, then I'll just let them stay in the sled. But if they're just a little bit tired and then peek their head out and want to start running again, I'll put them back in the line and they'll be fine.
Of all the races Seiji has competed in, he doesn't have a single story that stands out. He likes the gorgeous moments of being outside. However, he has a story about his big brother who used to mush.
For the Junior Yukon Quest, he had a pretty tough race. He lost five of his dogs.
How many dogs did he have?
He started out with 10. And he, at the last checkpoint coming back, he only had 15 miles left, and they were about to withdraw him because, you know, the banquet had already started and he wasn't finished yet. But he wanted to keep on going, so his dogs are so tired, he put a harness on himself and pulled the dogs to the finish line. For those last 15 miles, he actually walked in front of his sled, and he finished, and he got the Red Lantern, which is the award given to the last place finisher. But he finished, and he was super happy, and that race was super cold because it was down in Fairbanks and must have been like negative 30 to negative 40 degrees.
As Seiji scratches his favorite dog, Sapphire, he talks about the appreciation he holds for his sled team.
You get a big respect for the dogs because they pull you through that. They pull that heavy sled and yourself through all those harsh terrains, and you really come to love the dogs a lot. You want to be with them. You start missing them if you're away from them. Since most of the guys on my team are Christine's dogs, I only have four dogs of my own, but only two of them are in my race, so I see them every day. But most of these other guys I'm missing most of the time, and I just want to be able to train them as much as I can.
Seiji's team consists of leaders in the front to follow his commands and lead the team. Swing dogs are in the middle and pull the team. The wheel dogs are in the back of the team, and they need to be the strongest because it's their duty to change directions and turn corners. He explains what makes a good lead dog.
For the leaders, you need very serious dogs who have lots of endurance, because if your dogs, if they lose their attention, then your team won't be going anywhere.
Like all athletes, Seiji's dogs require lots of food to keep them energized. During the race, that energy is crucial.
We have different race mixes. They're basically, the race mix is different types of meat, like beef, liver, etc. And they just mix those together, and it makes a really good meaty treat for the dogs. And then for other substances, we have like fish oil that we can add with the dogs that gives them lots of tasty protein.
Without his mom, a lot of this wouldn't be possible. Seiji's mom is one of his team's biggest assets. She cooks his meals, provides transportation, fixes beat-up gear, and provides moral support. She's noticed that Seiji's team keeps getting stronger and stronger.
I think it gets better every year. We know what we're doing more, so we're more organized, and we're missing fewer parts, and we're attending to more detail each time.
Spending time with the dogs has taught Seiji a lot of things.
You definitely need patience in mushing. Takes lots of strength. If you have bad patience, then definitely you won't be able to handle being out there a long time, handling the conditions, being able to feed the dogs. Also, it costs a lot. It costs money, time, you need the equipment, you need the strength to be able to handle all the pressure and problems that the dogs have and give you.
He also has advice for anyone interested in mushing.
You definitely want to try mushing. It's super fun, and even if you don't like it, then you can say you've tried it and you know what's really exciting down here in Alaska. And I would say that if you're living in Alaska, then you need to go mushing at least once in your life, since it's one of the best things you can do out here.
That was a piece from a number of years ago by Ishmael Strever of the Alaska Teen Media Institute. Incidentally, Takagi came in 12th in the Junior Iditarod. Well, that's all for today's show. Earlier, we heard from Patty Higgins of the Abbott Loop Community Council's Dog Park Committee and Kathy Forrester, a dog park user. Next was Michael Hakadolin, an animal lobbyist and consultant, and we heard from Dario Schwerer in Switzerland with his top-to-top expedition. You can find links to all of them at OutdoorExplorer.com. Our producer for Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.